I would just say, just have one thing to say. A wise man once said that you give only to the extent and measure of the gifts that you've already been given. And all of us are standing on the shoulders, I think, is one way to put it, of other people who helped us out in the beginning. And so that's why I'm here. That, and I just like you guys. KK4JBQ.
Can I got it, Walt? So just gonna let you know, I came down here to spend all day outside down at the range today, and got down here when the sun started going down, so got the wood stove going. It's nice and warm in here. Opened the window and was messing with this new radio I got from, I bought from AK's estate. And opened the window, was messing with the radio about an hour or so after the sun went down, and the two hound dogs are blistering it. I mean, they are on the 12-mile right down here, not too far off. Well, they've moved on now, but I guess maybe an hour or so ago. Boy, they were on it. And I mean, he was on it. And I just, man, that was such a pretty sound. And I've been trying to listen to them, but they've kind of gone out of earshot, I guess, or down in hole or something. But you can just tell they are doing what they enjoy doing, and that's just a wonderful sound just to hear that, you know.
I lived up there off Blue Mill Road, up there at Landrum. My next door neighbor, he had two hounds. He coon hunted. And the landlord made him get rid of them hounds. They kept everybody awake at night. But I love hearing a hound, especially when they tree one. But I don't think they're going to tree that bear, will they?
I assume he's coon hunting, Walt. I don't know that for sure. But I assume that's what he's doing. They are dead on it. So the other thing I wanted to tell you is I am up at the deer camp and was able to get up on the South Carolina single sideband tonight. I mean, it was horribly noisy. Everybody was struggling. But I am completely off-grid and have made HF contacts and made contact in Lawton, Oklahoma with the radio and the dipole that y'all helped me build. And I just think that is just absolutely wonderful.
We cooned
a raccoon before. Just one. But I guess I have. I don't now, Walt, but I have before. There's a gentleman when I grew up with, his name was Barney Sloan. He's deceased now. But he had the community meat locker. People would bring, you know, deer and things like that, and he'd butcher it and had a cooler there. But I asked him if I could hunt coon hunt on his property one night. And he lived along the inlet that feeds Lyman Lake. And I treed a raccoon and killed it, shot it, and brought it back up to the house to show Barney. And his wife came out and looked at it, and Barney came out and looked at it, and we skinned it out for the hide, and he said, "Well, you come on over tomorrow night," and he says, I'll cook it for you. And I'll show you how to cook it, because I wanted to try it. So he stuffed that thing full of onions, apples, potatoes, and carrots, and wrapped it in bacon, and put toothpicks to hold everything together. And I gotta be honest, I mean, I don't remember what it tastes like, but I don't remember any bad, you know, anything that sticks in my mind to say it was horrible or terrible. But I have eaten one. Well, not a whole one, but I did try it.
My grandfather died. I promised him on his deathbed the night before he passed that I'd stay there and help my grandmother. And everybody within miles, if they went hunting and they kill a rabbit or kill squirrels or kill a coon or even caught with them old cork, they'd bring them to my grandmother. And I said, "God, you let me turn 18 and get grown, I'll never skin another animal again as long as I live." But boy, I love smelling a coon baking in the oven, and I would eat one now. But I bought my daughter a pony, and I ended up having to move, and I didn't have no pasture nowhere to put the pony. And I was working with Cecil's Incorporated down here out of Spartanburg. And on rainy days, we'd bring our equipment into the shop and work on it. And I can't think of that old guy's last name. His name was Ben. But he had a big gas cooker in there, and somebody was always cooking some kind of hash, goat hash, deer hash, some kind of hash. Well, I sold Ben that pony. And we was in there one day, and it was cold and raining, and he had that pot of hash going. And he gave me the first plate out of it and asked me, said, "What do you think about that?" It was good. It was just had a sweet taste to it. I said, "What is this, Ben? This can't be deer hash or goat hash." He said, "No, that's Sheba. He had killed my daughter's pony and made pony hash out of it." I couldn't eat any more, but it was eatable.
Oh. I don't know if I told nobody that. Oh, man. Oh, that's hard to even imagine. Oh, my goodness. Oh. All right, well, I see where this is going. So, worst thing I've ever eaten. So, Dad and I used to go to Florida, in a place called Buckville, Florida. And we would hog hunt. And we'd go for 3 weeks at a time. And, we ate the meat, but the guys we hunted with down in Florida, that was their staple. I mean, they, you know, I'm not going to say I'm ashamed to say that we were more in it for the sport, but that's basically what it was. But, you know, the guys in the club that we, hunting club we had there, they, you know, they took it and made something out of it. We'd bring back a little bit, but not much. we just couldn't enjoy the flavor, I guess. But at any rate, they would fix Haslett stew, and it was basically rice, Valdea onion, and then they would take the heart, liver, and the lung, and make a stew out of it. And I just couldn't do it. I mean, I tried it, but I could not tolerate it. There's no way. So I think that's been the worst thing I've ever eaten. I don't want to talk about snails, but the Haslett stew was pretty bad.
My dad, he always raised a couple of hogs during the summer, and we'd always kill them about January or February, and we ate everything, heart, liver. To this day, I love fried liver, and the lungs, he didn't waste nothing. Taking the bowl of the head down and the ears, the nose, and everything, and grind it up and make souse meat. And I think I'm the only one in my family now. I've still got a brother and a sister living, and they almost throw up when I say I want some liver mush or something, let alone say something about souse meat. But my grandmother, she'd even eat the chicken feet. That was a delicacy for her, the chicken feet, the chicken head. She'd just go out there in the yard and bring an old chicken's neck and take it in there and pour boiling water over it, pluck the feathers out, and then burn a brown paper bag and swinge the little feathers off of it. But she didn't waste nothing on the chicken. Now, I ain't never eat the chicken feet and the head and all. I won't even eat a chicken neck, but I brought it up. I ate about everything that was put on the table. You did, or either you went hungry.
Oh, goodness. I don't think I could do chicken feet, Walt. I just... There's no way. No way. But one interesting thing that we tried was we had the old man that was, he was the president of the club. His name was Witch Doctor. And he was the right man to manage the club, you know, the hunting club. And he was a cook. He'd get out there. He wouldn't hunt with us. Well, he'd come out there and hunt, but he'd come out there and fuss. And, you know, one day I was out on a crossing where, you know, the hogs would cross, and had my shirt untucked. I had a long sleeve flannel shirt on, and my shirt was untucked, hanging out over my britches. And he tucked your shirt in. You standing out here on the road for everybody to see. You know, you need to look professional. And I just never really understood that. But hey, he's president of the club, whatever, you know. But he would go back and during the day and would prepare a meal. So when we came in, you know, we had something to eat. And he went into Tallahassee one day and picked up some mullet, which is a fish. And, you know, me and Dad always use mullet for catfish bait. But he bought, I don't know how many pounds of mullet and the roe out of the fish. I didn't care much for the roe, but the fish itself was really good. I mean, it was good. I didn't think I, you know, could could do that, but it was good. He would make snacks for us during the day. He was a quail. He managed, had a bunch of quail that he kept in captivity for the meat and the eggs. And he would start collecting the eggs, you know, a couple of months before the hunt. And he had these half-pint jars, kind of like a jelly jar. And that was our snack for the day, was, you know, a hunk of bologna, some bread. And he would give us a half-pint jar full of pickled quail eggs. And those were quite good, you know, just the right size. And that was good. I got tired of the bologna. We had armadillo one night, didn't care for that. Rattlesnake, alligator, I didn't care for any of that. But just, you know, interesting time in my life to be a part of that and be a part of, you know, that kind of fellowship. I think we started hunting when I was probably 10 or 12 years old, and that's where I learned about fellowship and just having some good, clean, wholesome activity, you know. No drinking allowed. We'd have a campfire every night, and he made sure we were fed, and you know, just some good times in my life, and I remember. We had, at one time, we had 32 dogs. Dad would go down to the rail yard in Spartanburg and buy all of the busted dog food bags that came in on the railhead in Spartanburg. He would buy the busted bags, and I'd have to get in there with a shovel and clean up the dog food out of the rail car, put in 55-gallon drums, and that's what we fed the dogs with. It was good dog food, it's just they couldn't deal with the busted bags. But anyway, go ahead and take it. Larry, you still in there?
I'm still here. I'm enjoying the conversation. KK4, JPQ.
Hey, Chad, you talk about mullet. I was like you and your dad. I'd always use them for catfish bait to, when my ex-wife and I split up and I moved to Florida, moved down there and was staying with my brother. And those Jamaicans, you see these little peanut stands on the side of the road here? Well, down there, they had those Jamaicans, and man, you could pull into one of those little sheds and buy two smoked mullets for a dollar. And you talking about a lunch, I'm like you. I don't know if yours were smoked or not, but man, I love smoked mullet. I wish I knew how to cook them on the grill.
Smoked mullet. I've had smoked fish before, smoked salmon. But, so... Let me tell you a quick story. So, one year I got, when I got, promoted to platoon sergeant, they would give you the rank and you had 1 year to complete the training, which I, you know, always put a level of stress on you because when they sent you to school, at each rank you had to go to school and learn how to be a sergeant, and then learn how to be a staff sergeant, and so on and so forth. So I got promoted to platoon sergeant E7, and then went up to the administration office to find a school to go to. And the administrative clerk, they had a school in Arizona. Anyway, the state abbreviation was AR. So she put in for the school and got the state abbreviation wrong and put in, I think it was AK, which got my orders in the mail and ended up at Kodiak, Alaska. And that was a very interesting training. Spent 3 weeks up there going through advanced non-commissioned officer school right outside of Kodiak. I think it was in March, and I had a fellow classmate. His name was Harry Novak, and he was indigenous to the area. He was, I guess you could say, he was Eskimo. At the 20th day, we had to take one exam, pass or fail. If you didn't pass, you could take another exam, a different exam. If you didn't pass it, then you went home with your head between your knees and, you know, had to explain why you didn't pass. So, a little bit of stress there. But Harry was an interesting fella. On the 20th day, or the 19th day, he came down to my room. We drank a cup of coffee every morning because I brought a little coffee pot with me. And he said, "I'm going home. They're having a seal festival, once a year seal festival, where they, you know, have the tribe or whatever, the town, has, you know, processed seal meat and have a big festival where they all share the meat." And I remember telling him, "Harry, you know, we're testing out tomorrow. We've been here for, you know, 20 days. You can't just leave." And he said, "Well, I told him I didn't want to come here because I had the seal festival." And he packed his pack on his back, and we were standing out there in formation and watched him. And that young man took off across the countryside on foot and disappeared into the base of the mountain range. I mean, we lost sight of him at, you know, a couple thousand yards. But I just, you know, talking about weird foods and this, that, and the other, but I don't know about seal meat. I don't know about that. But I just remember he was an interesting fella. The flight ended up getting delayed. I spent another 3 days there after the training, which turned out to be a good thing because I got to do a little tour of Alaska. And one of the other guys in the class was a train engineer in Alaska. So he took me down to the railhead and you know, he was, after we graduated, he went back to work. But I got on the train engine and went, I don't know, about 100, maybe 150 mile loop on road in the main engine there, and went 150 miles on a rail track through Alaska. And that was some beautiful, wild country. And let me let this thing cycle. Stopped three times along the way because there were animals that had been obviously hit by a previous train or a vehicle or something, or that, you know, and they have, if the engineer spots an animal that's, you know, 50, 75 yards off the track, then he stops the train and radios in to dispatch and tells them, you know, hey, there's a moose here or there's a bear here or whatever. And they'll come and collect the carcass, and if it's still, you know, I mean, it's frozen. But if it's still edible, then the townspeople will come and collect the game and process it for the town. And I, you know, I just thought that was kind of neat. I do remember doing a tour of the antenna field there. Maybe it's in Fairbanks or somewhere right there, but it was right there on the coast. I don't think Russia's that far away, but it's basically this huge antenna array that just listens. I'm sure they could have transmitted too. But I remember seeing that. And, yeah, so, you know, interesting trip, but, you know, we're talking about weird food. Got off on something else, but seal meat, I don't think I could do that. Go ahead and take it.
Making rank in the Army nowadays is a whole lot different making rank in the, I was in the Navy Seabees. I went to Vietnam in E2. 9 months later, I came back in E5 without any classes or anything. E3 got bumped off, and you were the only E2 in your company. You made E3 automatically. And then if the E4 got bumped off, you made E4. That's how I come out of E5. But I made all my rank in Vietnam and never took a class. But that antenna farm you're talking about, that probably the one in Fairbanks. I was up there in Fairbanks for, we were up there about 3 weeks grading around that antenna farm up there. And then we left there with the Barking's Heads, Hawaii. But the darndest thing I ever seen, Chad, is the second time I went to Nam, I had to go through jungle warfare training, and they sent me to Sun Valley, Rhode Island, to go through jungle warfare training in January. 14 degrees was the highest I ever seen it up there, Chad.
When I was in, you had to have training. They're not gonna let you be in charge of America's most valuable asset, and that's its sons and daughters, if you don't have some kind of training. I didn't have any specialized training like, you know, jungle warfare, anything like that. I didn't have any desert training or survival training. I think we did a, you know, 1 or 2 day just kind of talk about it kind of thing. But, you know, really didn't just go out and do it. We wasn't anything special, you know. But, yeah, some of those classes get pretty long. You know, I got from when I moved from E8 to E9, the E9 class was, E9, you got to have you don't have to have a college degree, but you need to be at least 2 years into a college program. You sign a committal that, you know, you are going to complete the degree. And then the Sergeant Major's Academy was, there was a 1 year long internet. You had to attend school for 1 year on the internet twice a week for 4 hours. And then you had 6 weeks in El Paso, Texas at the actual academy. And I didn't enjoy that too much. It was, you know, hollering and screaming and all that mess. But I, you know, that's what I got to do to feed my family. That's what I'm going to do. But been to some interesting places. I don't remember how cold it was when I got to Alaska, Walt. I know it was cold. We had to take a PT test the first day. And I just remember my lungs were on fire. At 16 minutes, had run 2 miles in 16 minutes or less, maybe 17 minutes. And my goodness, it just, that cold air just, it was horrible on your lungs. But a beautiful place, just a beautiful place. Go ahead and take it, Walt.
14 degrees Fahrenheit to 6 weeks later to 116 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, that was a change. Why in the world did they send us to Sun Valley, Rhode Island to go through jungle warfare? I enjoyed it. I enjoyed boot camp. I enjoyed boot camp because of all the rough and tough guys that thought they were rough and tough. They were crapping out and crying, pretending to have nightmares and want to fight the fire guards at night so they could get kicked out and sent back home. But I enjoyed everything about the military. And with that, KK4, JBQ, get up and say something.
Hey, Walt. Chad, I don't know what to say. I don't have much to share on the topic. I've done some traveling around, but not in the ways that you guys have. So, I suppose I'm speechless. What do you say?
Well, I'll make sure I got it. Off topic then. That's all right with you, Walt. We'll talk about something. Maybe Larry can join in with us. So, traveling. So, I think the most interesting place that I have ever been, not World War II related, I guess. Well, it was, but some interesting things about a place that's not related around the military would have to be Stonehenge. Me and Anna and the kids went to the UK during one of our adventures. We homeschooled the kids for years. Anna was teaching us a section on I forget what it was, archaeology or something, one of those topics. So we just, you know, went down, got on a Space A flight, and ended up in the United Kingdom. So, of course, we, you know, went to Stonehenge and looked at that place. And and unbelievable. I mean, unbelievable. Walt, there was some of that stones that was made out of blue granite that are as big as your daughter's house. I kid you not. And those prehistoric people moved those stones 2,500 miles. And I don't know how many of them they are. 15 or 20, 30 of them, I'm not sure. But, man, you think about that for a minute. No excavators, no backhoes, no bulldozers. 2,500 miles is where they pretty sure it was quarried from. And just stand there in front of those things is just as enormous as they are. And when you see a picture of them, it just, you know, doesn't do it justice. Something gets lost in the photograph. But over one third of them is under the ground that you can't see. I have no idea how they did that, do something like that. But Larry, where's the most interesting place you've ever been?
Oh my, most interesting place. Well, I know. Gosh. That is really a tough question, not because there's been so many of them, but because I've been places that were new to me and wondrous, and as it wound up, not that my life is over yet, but it's very likely that's the only time I would ever be there. And maybe you can relate to this. If you stood there on the ground near Stonehenge, it might have occurred to you that you want to take in all you can see, all you can feel, everything about you. Use every one of your senses and try to remember that. I've been on the edge of Niagara Falls. There's, on the Canadian side, there's an observation deck. You wouldn't want to be there for a long time because the water spray would soak you. But I stood there and I knew I'd never be in that spot again. And I wanted to take it all in, and I wanted to hold it. I wanted to hold on to it. That was a good thing. And then in Michigan, I was out in the woods, and I kind of had a comfortable feeling in the woods. I always have, because I felt myself capable to get myself there and get myself out again and do what I wanted to do in the meantime. But I got hung up. I couldn't go backward. I was in a briar thicket, and I was all torn up by the time I got to where I was standing. And I didn't want to go back that direction, and I couldn't see any way forward. What was below me was what they call up there in Michigan a sinkhole. And so I didn't know what, if the ground would give way if I got further down in there and I just dropped for several thousand feet. I didn't know, you know. I was unfamiliar with it. So I stood in one place, and I must admit that I prayed for a sign to help me get out of this. And the sign that I got was just to be quiet. Just be quiet. And it'll come to you. And it did. I worked my way out. Of course, I'm sitting here now, aren't I? But that was a little bit of fear that I had reached the end of the road. And I haven't said enough to really give you the an idea of the way I felt, but I felt pretty out on a limb with no place to go. So there's a little bit. KK4 JBQ.
Go ahead, Walt.
I think the most beautiful place I have ever been was Vietnam. We were home 40s out of Cameron Bay there, but we spent most of the time we didn't even know where we were at, didn't even know what we were building until started taking shape. Whether it's going to be a chopper pad or a landing field or some sort of a temporary base or whatever. But that is some beautiful, beautiful country over there. I wish I could go back in peacetime, but it's hard for me to even trust Vietnam now during peacetime. And that was never declared a war. It was just a conflict, but that is some beautiful, beautiful country over there.
Make sure I got it. I think I'd have to say the same for me would be, the most beautiful place for me would probably be the United Kingdom. So I got selected 1 year to go through an exchange program with the British Army, and I went and spent some time in the UK, and then the UK sent a soldier over to spend time with us. And the soldier that was attached to me in the States was a female, and her name was Catherine Sprote. And she stayed there at the house with us, I think a week or so, and then we spent the rest of time in the field. But when I went with the British, they operate so differently that it was just a very learning experience. In the military, you have the Army, you have 24-hour rats, which is rations. So serve 4 meals a day. You just go to the chow hall and, you know, have midnight rats, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Fine food, you know. But there, we went to Sunnybridge in Wales. We spent, close to probably 3 weeks in Wales. And you get to see, you know, how they operate and everything you want to, you know, I mean, you know, the stuff that, you know, kind of, not secret, but some things, you know, you couldn't be a part of, or I couldn't be. But one of the interesting things was you got to see how they fed the troops. So they were issued a card by the Queen that was, they would go, well, so they had a lot of lamb or sheep. I guess mutton. I don't know what it was called. I don't care for it. It's too greasy for me. But the cook was the butcher, and we got in a little Land Rover and we went to the local village there in Wales, and he showed them the little card from the Queen, and he would write a number off of the card, and then he would, you know, whatever we purchased from him, he would bill the British government or the Queen. I'm not sure how all that worked. I know he got what he wanted out of the village from the little card. No money was exchanged. How the farmer handled that, I'm not sure. But the cook picked out the sheep, and some, you know, a bunch of fresh eggs and chickens and this, that, and the other. And would you take it back to the cantonment area? And he dressed it off site, you know, away from the chow hall. Was a little tent there, set up in Wales. And, you know, fresh vegetables, fresh this. I mean, it's not like our supply chain. I mean, you just, you know, you get it in a box. You don't know where it come from, you know. But that was very interesting to see how all that worked, or how that particular unit did it. I don't know if their main military operates that way. But this unit did. And, you know, that was interesting to be a part of. And no midnight chow. You ate what they served. And that was it. You know, you ate it, or you waited to the next meal, which was, you know, kind of interesting. The breakfast was, it was okay. Blood sausage, I just couldn't do. It had a lot of what I call baked beans. It looked, for breakfast, it looked just like a Van de Kamp's beanie weenie kind of things. But that was a staple at breakfast. And then, let's see, the blood sausage and baked beans and fresh bread. I really enjoyed the bread. But, okay, Larry, go ahead and take it.
Gracious me. I'm letting my mind wander into the way you tell your story, and then you pass it over to me, and my mind's blank. It's just awful. It's just awful. Oh, you were talking earlier about eating around a table and the kind of things that you could harvest from an animal that you wouldn't eat. I remember when I was a child, probably no more than eight, I ate around the table with one of my aunts, my dad's sister. Her name was Alma. She was a lovely little lady who was probably 4'2". Tiny and wiry, and nobody you wanted to be on the bad side of, really. Everybody around her was bigger than she, taller, you know, even her girls. But nobody messed with that Alma. And she was the most wonderful cook, just a plain country cook. And so she would talk about the things that we ate, talk freely about how she cooked it. I enjoyed that because my mother never talked to me about cooking. I even asked her once to teach me how to fry bacon and how to make biscuits and stuff, you know, that I knew I loved. And she said, boys don't need such things as that. She wouldn't teach me. And she'd give me excuses like, you can't even see the top of the stove yet. And this is true, you know. I was asking her before I could actually do anything at countertop level, you know. You need to wait until you can see the top of the stove anyway. And then you can stand on something and help me. Well, that never happened. She was determined that I wouldn't learn how to cook. But back to my Aunt Alma, she would ask you, she'd say, you'd be eating her food, you know, and she'd look at you and say, well, Larry, what do you love? And I'd say, well, everything, Aunt Alma, everything. I love it all. Well, she took that and ran with it. So the next time I'd eat at her table, she'd just look at me and say, don't you love it? she'd say that a lot. She'd say, don't you love it? Yeah, she was a darling woman. But she ate something from chickens that I wasn't comfortable with. She would eat the brains, and it was a delicacy to her tongue, and it gave me the creeps. But just because I was so small and I wasn't that terrible hungry. I mean, if I was hungry, and I have been, I'd eat anything. I'd eat the wallpaper off the wall for the glue.
7-3s and get out of here. I gotta get up early in the morning and get my grandson ready for school. So KK4 JBQ and K04 NUE, I'll let y'all two go at it, but I gotta get out here and get up there and take my medication and put some more eye drops in my eye and waiting on 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. So I'll say 7-3s. And Chad, you, Larry, thanks for sticking around. I always enjoy this part of the afternoon on Tuesday night. So 7-3s.
7-3s to you. And I'm going to just collect some of these emails during the week. I think next Tuesday I got a couple of antenna questions. I put an infed half wave up day before yesterday, and it's doing some strange things I don't quite understand. I don't think it's necessarily bad, it's just I don't understand what's happening, but I didn't want to bog down everything tonight with that nasty, nasty word impedance, but hey, I'll get you next Tuesday, but I'll collect the emails and send them forward, and that way that I encourage them to, you know, get on the net and start listening and get comfortable enough to where, you know, maybe they'll key the mic one day. I'm sure they will. But 7-3s to you, sir, and thank you for what you do. KO4NUE, I'm clear with you, and Larry, I'm gonna cut it short too. But I'll hang around with you for a few more minutes.
Get yourself some good rest, Walt. KK4JBQ. Yeah, I look forward to Tuesday nights also. I know I'll be amongst friends, and that's kind of important. So take care of your business and get some shut-eye. As KI4DOS says, you're going to examine the pinholes. You're going to check your eyes, your eyelids for pinholes. That's how he puts it. KK4JBQ. 7-3, Walt.
Yeah, man.
Hey. Oh, man. So, I was going to let you know, Gary got me today on radio. You know, the other night he was calling the net last Wednesday night, and he's friends with one of those guys down in Piedmont or something, and he I forget exactly how he worded it, but he just said that he was the ugliest man in the world besides himself. So Gary was picking on me on the radio today. And I said, well, at least I said, well, Gary, at least I'm not the ugliest man in the world, you know, referencing to last Wednesday. And he said, you're right. He said, but when I die, you're going to have a problem.